Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Happy Halloween and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Michelle Pache, and I'm here today with Dr. Tim Hayes and Dale Hoffman. We warmly welcome you to the show, and thank you for choosing to be with us. Today is October 31st, 2014. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk with our hosts. We encourage you to call in with your comments or questions, allowing you to actively strengthen and deepen your practice. So now let's give a spooky welcome to Tim and Dale in the process of learning and experiencing Aramaic forgiveness.
Okay, I'm scared.
You should be.
I'm very afraid. Well, is Dale with us yet today?
I don't see him with his hand up, and if you'd help me out there, because his number changes quite frequently, and I'm not really always sure what line he's calling from.
Well, Dale, if you're there, put your hand up. We'd love to hear from you.
There he is.
We need your help because it's All Saints Eve. This is a very holy time.
The world's going to end tonight, and no, I don't know what's going to happen, but...
It's a very holy time for some religions, so.
Dale. I saw two interesting, I guess they were blog posts today that I wouldn't normally look at. I just happened to come by them. One was said, I can't remember exactly what the first one was. It was something to the effect that, why are Christians so horrible? I believe it, or why do Christians act so horribly, or something along those lines. And I was like, well, that's interesting, and I started reading it. And then there was another one. The second one was from a guy that I'm actually aware of, Mark Osler, who's down at University of St. Thomas, and his post was called The Five Scariest Teachings of Jesus. And whenever I see things like that, I'm always kind of – I have to admit that I'm a bit entertained with things like that, because generally the expert, it's one of the reasons I don't call myself an expert ever. I'm not interested in it, but the expert usually that sort of espouses certain things, whether it's positive or negative in terms of Jesus' teachings, usually has absolutely no frame of reference in the language that it would have been originally spoken, so they really don't actually know in a lot of cases what certain things mean. And I've always been fascinated by that whole thing of, just the whole idea of the different teachings of Jesus. And unfortunate, I could say, that there's so much that, people have never really heard in terms of the teachings, because things are pretty much have been fed to us by experts. I put experts in quotes for the past 1,900 years in terms of the Yeshua teachings, and have been so far removed from the things that we know that they were, that it's almost like the frame of reference becomes more important than what we're actually seeing, trying to observe. And then we fight over the concepts and the ideologies and the religious beliefs and things, and we just miss the point of what's actually there. I find it unfortunate, but it also does keep me focused and keep me moving forward, continually, you know, finding for ways to be more and more open from, you know, whatever my ideologies or my own thought systems have been. So anyway, I actually like seeing things like that. I actually love reading atheist websites, because the great things about a lot of atheists is they'll hit on certain things and they'll say, okay, well then, if whatever this part of the Bible is true, then what about this nonsense? And they'll throw it out there. And a lot of times that it's really bad translations, that people don't know what it means. But other times it's like, wow, you know, they're really good at showing blind spots. And I think a lot of average Christians, whatever that word Christian means, would fight against an atheist saying, well, you're wrong and I'm right, etc. But, you know, humility's, to me, it's got to be part one of the game is, you know, like Michael was talking last week, the love the Lord your God, you know, to love the one true reality with, you know, I shouldn't even say reality, but the true actuality with all of your heart, mind, soul, and willingness, and realize that, you know, if we're not open to what other people's comments and critiques are, then we can't grow in a lot of cases. So anyway, I just thought it was interesting, some blog posts I saw today.
Well, it's always interesting to hear your take on those things, and I also like to read when people put things out and they say this is, they're trying to debunk something or they're trying to put forth a truth. And one of the things I've always liked about people like you and Albert LaChance is, and Michael, of course, is that I'm not going to believe anything, I'm going to try it. I'm going to apply it in my life, and if it works and helps me feel better and be more loving, then I'm going to use more of it because that's my goal. And it doesn't matter whether or not it was written in a certain scripture or somebody else claims ownership of the knowledge. One of the things I like about Guy Finley, he says, he frequently, when he's talking, people will say, well, so-and-so said that first. And Guy says, okay. I'm just saying what comes to me. Well, somebody else said that too. Okay, all right. and the idea is, as Guy says, these truths don't belong to anyone or anything. They're just the way the world works. And if you tap into how it really works and you apply it and it gets you good results, keep doing it. You know, we had the first session for my Thursday night Mindshifters group last night, and we watched the first hour and 20 minutes of Ian Lunghold's lecture on the Mayan calendars. Are you familiar with that lecture?
Not of the lecture, no, with him, but not that particular lecture, no, that I'm aware of, at least.
Well, it's a wonderful introduction to questioning some of the completely unquestioned beliefs in our culture. And one of his key points in the first hour of the lecture is that a calendar is the exact dead center of a culture because it tells you what that culture values the most. And the calendar that's been forced down our throats since Pope Gregory in 15, whatever, 80-something, is a calendar that only pays attention to the physical movement of our planet around our sun. And when our genius, in quotes, genius scientists and archaeologists found different cultures and found out that they had calendars that were 260 days, for example, or 360 days, our arrogant scientists thought, well, these primitive peoples don't even know how long it takes our Earth to move around our sun. When in fact, most of those cultures knew exactly, and they had a separate calendar that tracked the 365 and a quarter days. But these other calendars that had shorter days or longer number of days, they were tracking something other than the physical. And Ian says one of the laws that, or the only, he says it's the only law. And the only law is that what we focus on, we become conscious of. So we're living in a culture that has us focused on nothing but the physical movement of our planet around the sun, and therefore we're focused only on the physical, and therefore we've lost awareness of everything other than what appears to be physically obvious in front of us. And so it's a lovely lecture. It's a lovely set of questions. What if we choose to focus on something other than just the physical and the material? And what if we become aware of a whole different level of existence or a whole different way to approach things, as Yeshua was talking about? And Michael likes to talk of it in terms of when you hold that certain condition of love in your mind, which I believe the word was rachma, then you maintain your true self, your human life. And of course, most of us are trained to think if there's a body walking around, that means there's a human life there. And Yeshua was trying to direct us to a whole different level of awareness, that there's more to your life than just this physical energy system. Stir up anything for you, Dale?
You know, it kind of gets me thinking about one of those things that was on that five scariest teachings this morning. It was the thing that got me was, the first one that he had listed, I remember, was, I should go get the paper. I actually printed it out, where he said something along the lines of, he was talking about let your yes be yes, let your no be no. We're all used to that from Matthew 5, and anything more than this comes from the evil one. And, I mean, just although it's not exactly speaking of calendrical systems, et cetera, but one of the things that, you know, what he's basically saying there is really like let yourself remain calibrated, and meaning that, you know, like when we're talking about the freaking calendar systems that we're using now, it's like, forget it, it's a complete mess. And like as an example, when people say, I don't believe in astrology, I read the Bible, I'm like, well, number one, have you actually read the Bible? Number two, have you ever read the words of Jesus? Because he talks about astrology in every third line. And number three, people don't realize that it was literally not a belief system back then as it is today for some people. It was literally a way of life, as it also is today for some people. Life, everything was connected, whether, you know, the accuracy of that was on or not. You know, they were doing their best to stay calibrated to whatever was actually happening on most levels of existence. And that's kind of, you know, when Yeshua was saying, let your yes, no be no, anything more than this comes from, when you say from the evil one, there's nothing that's, the word one is nowhere in that phrase in Aramaic. I'd have to look at it in a Greek Bible. But the word one's not there. All that it actually says is anything less to this is from Bisha. And interestingly, Bisha is one of those words that it's in the Lord's Prayer when it says, it says, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. That word evil is just an awful word, really bad translation. But what evil means is unripe. Or one of the words that I've been using today, you could say not calibrated with truth, not calibrated with actuality. It's that sort of false layer that we put over things that keeps us out of the present moment. And, you know, one of the ways that I often explain that is, and you can look at this really in any layer, level, or area of life. If you're going into a situation and you're going into that situation and everything's firing on all cylinders, you're at the peak of the temple or the pinnacle of the temple, which just means that, you know, your energy is wide open. And what happens is when your energy amps up in your temple, anything that is going to hinder or hamper that expansion and the evolution of your temple, or that expansion of the light, is going to start resonating up. This is something that virtually no one gets, I think, that hasn't been exposed to Michael's work. He got this in ways that I don't know that I've ever heard of any teacher ever in history that ever got it the way Michael gets that, that when you get into that amped up state of expansion, the system looks like it's at the point of what's called entropy. Bill Harris from Centerpoint, the Centerpoint Corporation, he calls it the evolutionary moment of truth. And what happens is, like as an example, when Yeshua was saying, let your yes be yes and let your no be no, anything less than this is from evil, it's saying, look, if you can't do it clean and clear, understand that if you are reacting to something or you are, you know, in the middle of some kind of a situation and someone says something and then it resonates your stuff and you feel like you're in hostility or fear, realize that if you can't just say yes or no and be clean and clear, or you can't be in, let's just say, a clean and clear conversation and recognizing that any kind of resonance you have is yours. It has nothing to do with the person in front of you except as a trigger. When you can realize this, you can actually live consciously in life and make choices in terms of the responsibility of the realization that, okay, hold on, if I feel off here, then all that they simply are is a catalyst. They're the trigger for this. They're pushing the button that's already there in me. But I need to be able to see this situation clearly. Maybe I'm not able to, like, go through some sort of intensive forgiveness process right now in this moment, but I can understand that whatever feels off in the system, that's mine. That's my bushel basket over my light, and realize this is not about them. This is about, you know, if I'm – I'm not quite in perfect alignment, like when it says in the worksheet, if I'm in pain, I'm in error. That's not quite actually it. It's if I'm suffering, I'm in error. Pain is pain. You know, pain is just something telling you, hey, something's off in the system. And pain can still be there, including after the forgiveness process. But it's the suffering. It's the suffering. That's the not allowing ourselves to feel what's resonating in relation to that pain. And, you know, when he's saying let your yes be yes and let your no be no, anything less is from the evil one. That word evil, bisha, means unripe, which means not now, not fully conscious, present in this moment. Not evil as in something bad, but like it was also an archery term that if you fired and you completely went off target, that scorekeeper would yell back bisha, which meant you were totally off target, take another shot, you know, constructive criticism. And if we could realize that any evil is simply that projection of our own consciousness that feels like there's some need or goal that needs to be met before I can be fully open, conscious presence and coming from that conscious, active, present love right now in the space of this moment. Anything that blocks that is what we call evil. It's our sins. It's the things that are unripe, the things that aren't out in the light. It's the shadows that we don't look at. And he's saying that in terms of, like, if you're going to make a declaration of something, it's interesting because earlier in that phrase, he says, do not swear. Now, the interesting thing about swear is it doesn't actually mean swear. What it actually says is do not lie in your oath, is what it says in Aramaic. That's an interesting thing. What that's saying is it doesn't mean, you know, I don't put your hand on a Bible and swear if you're in a court of law. You know, most theologians don't even know what this means. What it actually means in Aramaic is that if you make an oath, do your oath cleanly. If you're going to say, okay, this is what I stand for, this is what I'm standing by, this is what I'm standing within, do that cleanly and clearly. Do not lie in your oath. Be 100% calibrated. Be 100% honest, you know, coming from that conscious, present place rather than saying that you're going to commit to something and knowing you're going to break it, or saying yes when you know that you're kind of going to hedge on that a little bit. It's funny because I have to pull a Greek, like while we're on the show, I'll have to pull one of my Greek Bibles off the shelf here. Here's one, and see what it says in Greek, because in Aramaic, it doesn't say do not swear in any way. What it says, when you make an oath, do not lie in that oath, meaning be conscious, you know, be completely honest, be calibrated. And that's just such a perfect example of, if you're looking at, you know, European translations that are 1,500 or more or less years removed from when things were originally written down, forget it. I mean, and here we are out here, so many, bless everyone, you know, whatever you want to call yourselves. I don't call myself anything. I'm not a Christian. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a, you know, a doctor. I'm not a, you know, a minister or a reverend. I don't care about any of that stuff. I'm kind of okay with mystic or maybe philosopher or scholar, but I don't even care about that really. I just want to be open. And if we could just realize that, you know, where so many people are arguing for something that they don't actually know about in the first place. We're out there, and that's what we do. We've done it since we were kids. Someone says, it's this, and you say, no, it's not, it's that. You know, no, that girl's bike down the street is green, it's not red. It's like, no, it's not, it's red. No, it's green, it's red. No, it's green. And then you go down there half fighting with your brother or your best friend, and you get there, and it's like, it's neither, it's pink. And it's like, hello. And we argue for those things. It makes me think of the Course in Miracles, where it, you know, it says, would you rather be right or happy? Or would you rather be right or happy? I mean, that kind of sums it up. It's like saying, look, if you're going to be in situations, be clean, be clear, allow yourself to be calibrated, which means you have to take responsibility for what's yours as opposed to projecting that onto your mind's image of the person standing in front of you or whatever it is that's in front of you, traffic, you know, dogs, whatever. And it's the aspect, it's the most important base element of life, of consciousness, of everything. It's the first law that Yeshua spoke of, to be an absolute calibration, to be in that open space of that moment with, you know, God, self, mind, heart, and on all levels. And the second law is with anyone you encounter. And yet it seems to be the number one thing that's mangled and thrown out the window instantaneously. I judge you for, you know, loving some of the same sex. I judge you for liking the wrong music. I judge you for dancing. There was a dance, I believe it was in Utah last weekend, a homecoming dance. The police showed up and actually shut the dance down because they were dancing at a dance. A homecoming dance, the cops showed up because it's against the religion. And I can't remember if, I don't know that that was Mormonism, so I don't want to make that call. But how far off can we be that we're out there judging someone outside of ourselves when all the while we're nourishing that cause in our own heart? You know, that in which we find fault within another is actually ours. If we could just get that, if we could just get it, just... It really keeps me committed and focused on not some future goal, but being as open in the moment as I can, so that everywhere I go, I'm constantly sort of being in that light and sending the light out without much of any concern of it ever coming back. I'm sending it out, and I'm sending it out, and I'm, you know, sort of bearing that fruit and bearing the fruit and bearing the fruit. And it's like for the first time since, you know, I started doing this, all of a sudden the fruit's coming back, and I'm starting to see it in the culture while I'm also seeing things falling apart. But the things that are falling apart need to fall apart. Let them fall apart. Unfortunately, I'm not saying that people need to be hungry and homeless, but what I am saying is the, you know, the frames that are around those things that aren't calibrated, speaking of, like, you know, the systems of calendars, the things that aren't calibrated, they can only last for so long until you get backed into a corner, and you either have to let it go and, you know, admit that this doesn't work, or just keep plodding along and destroy everything in the process. So anyway, it's a long take on it, but it's something that's so incredibly important.
It's a good one. It's a good take on it. Well, let's ask Michelle if there's anything going on in the chat room or anybody with their hand up in the phone queue.
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, there's probably 10 people, in, well, let's see, some people in the chat room right now, and one comment from Angela, who is in Alaska. It's in the evening over there, I think. Maybe it's, well, nevertheless, she was so thankful that you had turned her on to the Lungold movie, the mind calendar thing. She had watched it yesterday, and so we've been chatting about that, and she really, really enjoyed it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
It's been one of my favorite lectures for years.
No, I pulled it up when she mentioned it, and I saw there was quite a few Google entries to look more into that. But very patiently, Bernie has been waiting on the phone here, so let's say hello to her. How are you doing?
Good morning. This is Bernie.
Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
How are you doing? I'm really interested in this Aramaic, well, in every day, but in this Aramaic Friday is exciting to me, so I appreciate it. One of the things when you were talking about, you know, it triggers so many questions, that when you were talking about being calibrated and that you're yes, be yes, then you said the swearing was actually do not lie in your oath. So your oath would actually be your yes and your no.
Yeah, it's your commitment. Your oath is whatever that commitment is. And that would be, as an example, when we think of swear today, we think of either swear as in, you know, cursing, Or we think of, which could have an aspect of that in it, or we think of swearing as, you know, put your hand on the Bible and swear that you're going to do something. But putting that hand on a Bible, what that really is, that the Bible is almost like a novelty in that. What that really is it's the best that we have, at least in our American legal system, of getting people to commit to an oath of, I commit to be honest, I commit to be accurate in everything I say. So I'm holding myself on this, you know, sort of common ideology known as the Bible that a lot of people agree in, because they know that a lot of people believe enough, you know, what on some level in the Bible that that's what they can commit them to. But I'm pretty sure that at least half, if not more, of the people that put their hands on a Bible in a court of law couldn't care less about the book. But I mean, it's the system we have. But yeah, it. And that's where the yes, yes, and no, no is, because it's saying, if you're going to do it cleanly, do it clearly, and if you make that commitment, know that you're going to live that commitment. It doesn't mean swear in the way that we seem to think today, so.
Well, I love that when you, I mean, it's just a light bulb went on my head when you were saying that the, let your yes be yes, let your no be no, is actually stay calibrated. And I thought, no. That makes so much sense. That just puts a lot of pieces together. So I appreciate you for that, because it gives me an even higher level to achieve than my yeses and my noes or my decisions or my commitments. So I thank you for that. The second thing I had was, and the third thing will be, but I'll come back to that, is, if you could give me an Aramaic translation of the word begotten, because we talk about the only begotten son. And I looked up begotten in the dictionary. It's not there, so I'd like to get back to that. But before that, you said Jesus talked about astrology in, you know, almost every other line. And could you give me an example of that? Because I don't have the lines right here, but could you expand on that a little bit more so I can go and look at that?
Well, I'm not quite, I don't know if it's my connection or yours or whatever. I heard about the begotten. I couldn't quite hear what you were saying about the, all I could really pick out was something to do with astrology, and you wanted clarification on something.
So Dale, you had mentioned that Yeshua talks about astrology in every third line. And Bernie's asking for an example or two so she can go dig into it. What did you mean by him talking about astrology all the time?
Well, he's always talking, he's always making reference to the sun. He's making reference to, as an example, a lot of people don't realize, I think the best way to do it is to go out and purchase, you know, dig in and find some books that actually talk about it that could go a lot deeper than me. Like, as an example, the reference to the two fish, the reference to him talking about the slaying of the bull and coming into, he's constantly talking about the turn of the ages. The bull is Taurus and going into, I'm trying to remember what the reference is. Two fish really has nothing to do with Jesus taking two fish and feeding thousands of people. It was actually the two fish was the astrological Egyptian symbol that goes back about 5,000 years of Pisces, which was the water bearer. Which was, when he's constantly talking about ages, he's constantly talking about different aspects of astrology, and we can't actually call it astrology, because it wasn't astrology then, it was actually life, it was the way life is lived, and it was much more connected than, you know, than we, today, astrology is like a modern ideology of the way they actually believed back then, but it's so threaded into the teachings that it's almost difficult to even say, here's one, there's one, and pull them out. What I would say is, like, start Googling it and start, I know it's a funny way to say Google. There's actually a book that I'm going to recommend, and I'm going to go real quick on a website here. It's from Andrew Gabriel Roth. Andrew Gabriel Roth is the guy who, the Aramaic Bible that he used, the one that comes from the Kabbalists and the Peshitta, the Aramaic English New Testament, is actually from Andrew Gabriel Roth. And he's got a book, I believe it's called Wheel of Stars. It's not on my bookshelf where I am right now. Here we go, Wheel of Stars. You can go to wheelofstars.com, and you'll see about the book and Andrew talking about it. He actually talks about the calendar systems. It's a spectacular book. He put it out maybe 5 or 6 years ago. He talks about the prophetic calendar, the pre-Metonic calendar, the mechanics of how they came up with them. But he also wraps in what we today would call astrology, but what back then was just life. As an example, the 12 tribes of Judah were derived from the zodiac, which, of course, is where the 12 disciples come from. It's the code of Jesus teaching in the temple at the age of 12. The temple doesn't have to be a physical temple that you go to, although that's the storyline in the Gospels. That could very well have been the way they wrote back then, is they would create stories to relate metaphors and idioms and syntax and things that, if it wasn't in story form, as soon as it got translated into a different language or it dropped into the lap of someone who wasn't conscious, if it wasn't in a story, metaphor, or parable form, the meaning would get lost. So the way they would actually write things back then weren't necessarily this historical thing happened. A lot of people just don't realize that today. Things were written in metaphor, not necessarily, or very rarely actually, as this is what happened when it was in sacred texts, but rather here's a story, and this story is going to help me. I'm going to use this great person as an example, and I'm going to give you a story. But if you're obsessed with the literality of the story, you miss the message that's there. But his book, it's called Wheel of Stars, The Ancient Biblical Calendar of the Future, from Andrew, and it's really a spectacular it's several hundred pages. It's really in-depth. You can go to wheelofstars.com and get the book. But he also is the guy who put out the Aramaic English New Testament, which is, in terms of people getting a New Testament that's Aramaic, that you can actually see the Aramaic or in Ashurit, which is basically Hebrew letters on the right side, and see a translation on the right. And the big value is not even in the translation. It's in the footnotes, and it's in the bibliography and all of the things that happen on the bottom of the page that reference, you know, the text itself. But what I'm saying is, you know, if you dig into Andrew's book, that'll be one huge opening. But also the work of a guy named Timothy Freke, F-R-E-K-E. I talk of him a lot, Tim Freke. He's a friend of mine. He wrote a book called The Jesus Mysteries and several others. And it's threaded within a lot of his book, you know, uncracking open the codes of a lot of the astrology. It's all over the place. And it's so threaded in that I would say there's probably a lot that we don't even, no matter how much you know about it, 2,000 years later, a lot of it we're not even seeing. But a lot of things were coded in there. And it was so different and so completely far removed from the way that we think of things like that today, that we look at things and we think we're reading a story that happened, when we don't realize that we're getting something that's coded, that's not meant to be taken literally. It's meant to be sort of opened from within. And the wider, you know, your vision becomes, the more you learn and the more open you become, the more it makes sense, I could say. So
that's great. And that gives me, now that you've explained what you were meaning about that, I can see a lot of areas, because I've done quite a bit of reading in the astrology arena and other books and such like that. So I'm looking forward to this one. And I think also, just as you were talking, is that one of the reasons that the East and the West is having so much trouble communicating, and, you know, with all of the chaos and everything that's going on, is because the Eastern language, the Arabic language, and the Eastern language do more of this, where they talk in stories. I was reading a book where it says that almost all the communication is via story, and there's a lot of exaggeration, and there's a lot of examples and such. And the Western mind just does not understand that. And so I think that's the same thing you're saying with the biblical, the Greek and Latin biblical translations, is that our minds are not so calibrated or so fixed in the physical that we don't really understand that at the time. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
And then begotten, the word begotten, because I can't find anybody who can tell me what the word begotten means, and I've looked it up in the dictionary. I can't find it there. So if you have some Aramaic insight into begotten, that'll be my
Sure. the reason you're really not going to find what begotten means, because begotten's not what the word was, and therein lies the challenge. Now, what's interesting is at least in the earliest texts of the Gospel of John that we have, the word that was there going back, even, I'm not sure, but as far as I'm aware, in the original Gospel of the Beloved Disciple, which is what the Gospel of John was originally called, and it wasn't originally about a man, it was about a woman, actually, and it was regendered in the second century, but in the earliest texts, the hints or the things that we get from historians and some other texts are that the line John 3:16 was actually not there. It was something added. Now, this is in the conversation of Yeshua to Nicodemus, and that it was a marginal note on the right-hand side of a page, and I don't remember the exact year, that was supposedly integrated into the text. Now, that's just part of this. Part of it is the word that's there in Greek in the earliest text that it is there is monogones. It's called monogones. Now, what's interesting is when texts were copied, the originals were usually destroyed. So the oldest ones that we have, monogones is there, even though we get echoes in other texts and from other people saying that it wasn't originally there, it was added. But we don't have the originals where it's not there, so we just sort of take what's there. Now, the interesting thing about monogones is, where he says, what we have in the English from the King James is, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever shall believeth in him shall not perish, but shall have everlasting life. Now, it doesn't actually say only begotten Son. The word is actually, first of all, monogenes. Now, monogenes is an interesting word in Greek because it wasn't actually clearly defined until the 4th century. And it was defined in the year 325 AD at the Council of Nicaea. They had four different possible definitions that they could choose, and they picked one. And the one that they picked as the definition from doing it through from the Greek and bringing it into Latin is only begotten. Now, the reason they were saying, okay, was he begotten as a human? Was he a human being with divine qualities, et cetera, blah, blah. So what they came up with, simply begotten, technically, or only begotten. Now, that's an interesting thing, because here it is for 400 years before they actually define it. It was actually in the text. And the reason that they chose only begotten was because of what people knew of Horus. Horus was a sun god of Egypt, 3000 BC. I've talked about him on the show before. Born on December 25th of the Virgin Isis Mary, Three kings followed the star in the east to locate Horus's birth. He was teaching in the temple at the age of 12, baptized at 30 by Anup, which began his public ministry, traveled about with 12 disciples, healed the sick, raised the dead, walked on water, turned water into wine, was dead for 3 days, arose on the third day, and he was called the way, the truth, and the life, the only begotten Son of God, the Lamb, the Good Shepherd, the Son of God, the Good Son, the Ripe Shepherd. All these different phrases that Horus was, and of course, that sure sounds strikingly familiar to the Christian story, because people just haven't studied Christianity enough to know that most, not some, not half, but most of the storyline of the life of Jesus isn't Jesus. It's actually Horus, and it's coded mythology that was thousands of years old at the time. Now, what's intriguing is that the earliest Aramaic texts that we have, John 3:16, is in there, so we don't know how far back and what language they were working in when it was integrated, when that marginal note was integrated, or if that even happened. Now, in Greek, monogones is mono, which means one, and gones, which means born or birthed, or you could say begotten. Now, the interesting thing about begotten, begotten doesn't technically mean born in the way that we think of the word born. What begotten actually means is born, but not necessarily like a human being. That was sort of birthed through, like the divine birthing into what we would think of as a human body, but it's kind of technically saying that they're almost saying Jesus was not human, that he was literally the only Son of God. Now, I'm going to sideways go to Aramaic, because in Aramaic, the word is echadiah or yichadiah. Now, yichadiah is a word that had been in poetry, Aramaic poetry, for thousands of years before the life of Jesus. It was a term that had floated around for thousands of years, and people knew what it meant. And I'm going to tell you what the word meant. Now, if he's talking to Nicodemus, he would not have been talking in Greek. He was talking to the leader of the Judeans, so it would have been absolutely a Semitic language. It would have most likely been Aramaic, because that was the lingua franca of the day. And it could have come out in Hebrew, which is the sister language of Aramaic. But the sounds yachad-ayah, this is the word translated as only begotten in Aramaic. The ayah sound, I'm going to go backwards, the ayah sound at the end of yachad-ayah, ayah is a word that means either something that has no beginning, or it means basically no beginning or no end or no boundary. Something that is not located in a particular place, but it's actually everything. It realizes that it's one with everything. It's also at the end of the word Shemaya, which is the word heaven, which means that heaven's either everywhere or it's nowhere. Heaven is not a location, which is what he said to Pilate. He said heaven, or technically what he said was my Malku, my kingdom that you're calling me a king of, isn't located from a place that you can see with your eyes or walk to. It's not in time or space, because it's not a place or a location, it's a state of being. And heaven would be the same. Heaven is that state of being where you're one with everything and there's no limit. There is no boundary. There's no beginning and no ending. You're one with everything. Now, right before the ayah sound in Yechidayah is the sound chud. Chud is literally the word one in Aramaic. It's the first number of the numerical system in Aramaic is chud. So right there you've got either one or only, meaning single one, only one. Now, the first sound is the yah sound, and the interesting thing about yah is what yah means, it points back to Yahweh, which means the non-manifest, you know, the consciousness of God or the consciousness of the one truth. But what it also means is who, but yah doesn't mean who as in like you who as a person or Jesus who. It means the I within the I or the who within the who, like our highest awareness, our highest consciousness, you could say, higher self. So what it actually means in Aramaic is one who is absolutely single, one who is one with everything. There's so many ways you could say it. Generally, it's translated as the one in Aramaic. Now, the one doesn't mean the only one separate from all others, and Jesus even said that. It's not me, it's the one within me. And he said, you can do all that I've done and even greater things, which means if he's only begotten, we can be too. Because if he's only begotten and we can't be the only son, meaning one with everything, the only true creation, Meister Eckhart said that God is always begetting the only begotten over and over and over again in every moment. Mm-hmm. If we couldn't be that only begotten or that one who is single with everything, one united, no veils between me and truth, me and the absolute, what we would call God, reality, Yahweh, whatever. If we couldn't be that, then he never would have said, you can do all that I've done and even greater things, because that would have been a lie. So what that term actually means is you are literally the one, not as the only one separate from others, because that would be the opposite, actually, of what only begotten means. It doesn't mean the only one of privilege who's separate from all others and others can't be that. That's the opposite of its meaning. What it actually means in Aramaic is you're one with everything. And if I'm one with everything, so are you. And so is Tim. And so is Michelle. And so is everyone else, Michael, Jeannie, whoever you want to say. But only it's when it reaches our awareness that we know that we're one with all that's real. We know that we're one with God. We know that we're within that oneness. When you're in that, in the depths of your realization outside of just belief systems or religion or ideologies, that's what it meant to be only begotten. You could say, you know, maybe use an example of Buddha, Jesus, you know, Paramahansa Yogananda, whatever that may be. You're one with, you know, you've got cosmic consciousness, Christ consciousness. Christos, of course, is a Greek word that means channel of God. So there you go. I mean, it's big. It's a lot different from what Christianity doesn't actually even know what it means. So,
and that's what I found out, you know, because I've asked a lot. The other, okay, as a talent, what does begotten mean? And there are no answers or anything. But as you're talking to me about this and dividing that word up and giving me the different meanings, my mind went back to begotten would comport with celebrated.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of it. And when you're calibrated, you realize that you're not separate from, you know, the thing that I often say is when we look in the mirror, there's nothing, you know, we're not in any way separate from that which we observe. But yet what's in the mirror is not real. It's simply a reflection. And in the words of St. Francis of Assisi, I always use this quote, what you're looking for is what is looking. We're looking for the only begotten, yet that's us when we realize who we are. And that was the difference between Son of God and or Son of Man, as in the one who is born from a person, as opposed to the Son of God, which that word doesn't mean son as in just born from God, but that you realize you are God, put simply. So, and Christianity won't allow you to be God, even though that was the whole point of everything Yeshua was teaching. So they won't allow it.
You had mentioned the Course in Miracles where it says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth. And in the Course in Miracles, you probably remember, he says, Jesus says, it was, for God so loved the world that he gave to the world.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And it's funny, too, because in a lot of cases where you see something like to or follow, a lot of times in Jesus' teachings, what those usually mean is through or from. Like when he, as an example, says, those who follow me, but in most cases he didn't actually say follow. He actually says comes through me. And, you know, like the I am phrases, he wasn't talking about himself as in I, Jesus, am the bread of life. He was actually speaking of, again, the who within the who, which is that singular nature of our being where we're not separate from God, you know. And when he said, when you come from that, then you'll see the truth of what I'm talking about. If you're not coming from that, you can't see it. If you're looking here and there, if you look in the clouds, if you know, heaven's not in the sky because if it was, the birds would get there first. It's not in the water because the fishes would get there first. He said that in the Gospel of Thomas. He's saying, look, if you're looking for it in physical reality, or someone says it's here or it's there, or that the Messiah is here or there, realize they're lying to you. Because of the Messiah you cannot see, because the Messiah is our own being when we awaken into the truth that we are the ultimate reality, when we sort of drop that mortal coil or shell in our mind that separates us from that truth. So, yeah, it's really, really beautifully profound in so many ways.
Is there, I wanted to ask, is there anybody else waiting in line to talk? Because I have one more question if there's not.
I don't know. I don't know what the...
Bernie, you're going to have to speak up a little bit. I couldn't hear your last question.
I asked, is there anybody in line with their hand up?
Michelle,
because
what do you say?
No, nobody's here with their hand up right now.
Okay, then I'll go and ask my next question.
Wonderful.
Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you. And in traditional Christianity, that is translated, or, you know, people say that he went to heaven, went to a place, prepare a place. And that, you know, I know that that's not what the meaning was, but if you could give me some insight on the Aramaic to that part.
What he's basically saying is, I am in that open space, and I'm keeping the door open for you. I'm keeping the space open for you. It's not a location that you're going to. It's saying realize that. And, you know, of course, we don't keep the – by him keeping the space open within his own consciousness, it makes it easier for the next person. And as an example, if you're around like a negative, awful, you know, depressed person – you're not going to be, you know, the happiest being in the world, no matter how positive your disposition may be, unless you're going in and forgiving a lot of those things that are in your system that's resonating within the depression of the people around you. And, you know, he's basically saying, look, I'm in the space, and that space is open. And I'm, you know, another place where he mentions something similar is in Matthew 28:20, where it says, I am one with you even unto the end of the world, unto the end of the age, unto the end of time. But what it actually says in Aramaic is ina amkuna ina, which doesn't mean I am one with you. It means I am one with I. I am one with the I within the I, which is that who that I was speaking of, the highest self. I'm one with the I of everything. And it goes on in Aramaic and says, in every present moment or every now moment, in the anticipation of the ceasing of your concept of a word in Aramaic that's Alma or De Alma. And what De Alma means is Leshulame De Alma. What Leshulame De Alma means is the ceasing of our concept of the world, of what Michael would call reality, of this false, illusory, fake world, false self that we put on top of truth, on top of actuality. We layer on top, we layer all these bushel baskets on top. And what he actually said in that phrase wasn't, I'm waiting for you when the world ends, and I'll be here when the world ends, or when you die, or at the end of some astrological age. What it actually says very clearly in Aramaic is I, what appears to be this physical human Jesus, is one with the I within the I, and I wait there, and I'm going to be there in every single present now moment in the anticipation of you letting go of the world, so that you realize when you're fully present in the moment and you don't have all these layers of goals and bushel baskets and things that you're needing out of the moment, when you allow yourself to rather not look for water of needing something, but rather be thirsty, which means to be open, which is also the Aramaic idiom of having salt within yourself, which meant to be parched, which doesn't mean to be thirsty in that sense. What it means is to be open. It means to always be open to receive more, always be empty, always be in that space. And he was saying in Matthew 28:20, I'm already here. I'm one with that I within the I, and I'm here with great anticipation for that present moment, that present now, when you let go of your world, you let go of your bushel baskets, you let go over the begotten part and realize that nothing has borne forth from God except from God. And when you drop that, I'm right here in that moment, and that's when the world ends. And that's when we transition from Son of God to Son of Man. So, or Son of Man to Son of God, I should say.
Yeah.
And that word son doesn't mean son as in child. It actually means channel, vessel, or conduit. It actually means a delivery system or something that, you know, is that open flow. So
beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much. That is,
oh, absolutely.
Cleared up. I mean, just cleared up so many veils and made everything kind of comport with everything else. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. I'm honored. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bernie. That was wonderful, and thank you, Dale. That's, you know, there. It's what's amazing is, unless I'm mistaken, you still haven't read or tuned into the Way of Mastery.
Not really. It's just been a time thing. I do still have the link, but no.
Well, you probably don't need to, because as I'm listening to you, I'm hearing phrases, chunks, paragraphs that could have come right out of it. And of course, that's almost identical to what I hear and I read in A Course in Miracles. So, you know, when it's an accurate description of how things are, even if it's not the exact same words, if you're accurately seeing how things are, it's all the same.
That's exactly it. Yeah, when it's calibrated, you know, when it's funny that I say calibrated, because calibrate is the closest word we have in English, but probably the best way of what Yeshua was saying wasn't necessarily calibrated so much as he was saying when it's purely calibrated and it's absolutely, you know, your compass is on true north, when you're purely calibrated, the calibration is gone, because there's no longer you plus the truth that you're recalibrated to. When you recalibrate the truth, you disappear, you die. You know, your human self, you know, in terms of as being separate from anything else, dies. So it's almost like when we recalibrate, the recalibration almost nullifies itself, because you don't need to recalibrate again once you're, and that's, you know, in any present moment, when you're fully open in the moment, there is no, that's why if you're sitting there talking to some people or one or two people, you know, you, like if I do a recording, when I record in a studio or wherever with just myself, it's not the same thing as me being even with a little circle of 10 people. And my newest CD, The Primal Voice, was actually recorded in someone's home. Most of it was recorded in someone's home, the rest in a studio, because I wanted to be able to have that open space. And when all of us are calibrating like that and we're all sort of in that open present moment, and I'm offering it as service, not just into a microphone, but to other souls in front of me, the more open and the more service-oriented, you know, what Gandhi said, the best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. The more I'm pouring out, the more, you know, that the infinite is flowing through me selflessly, absolutely selflessly, the more magical the conversation becomes. And it's not magic, actually. The more calibrated, the more deep, the more profound it is. And it tends to be easier when you're surrounded with people that are actually in front of you, because you can give it to them then and there, as opposed to sort of speaking into a microphone. Eckhart Tolle's got it right. You know, other than reading his books, he doesn't do audio programs where he goes into a recording studio unless he's reading one of his books as an audio book. He does everything live, and that's the way it needs. You know, really, really, that's kind of the way to keep it, you know, the most calibrated. So, anyway.
Well, that's a lot. And, of course, we didn't mention it at the beginning, so I'll mention it now. One of the primary tools for removing what doesn't belong and allowing that clarity of focus to allow us to stay in touch with our true nature and to keep calibrated is the Reality Management Worksheet, or the Forgiveness Process, from the Ancient Aramaic. And Dr. Rice makes that available on his website at www.whyagain.org. And if you click on the bullseye on the front page or the link that says Start Here, it takes you to a page where you can download Chapter 24 of his book for free and read it. And that explains that forgiveness process, or the worksheet process. And it also lets you download the latest version of the worksheet and a lot of, maybe 12 or more hours of audio of internet shows like this, where people have called in and Dr. Rice or Jeannie or someone else has actually stepped them through that forgiveness process. And you can find on that one page for free download more than you'd ever need to get started. And of course, if you get started and you start applying this to yourself, you can choose to become a master at this ancient art of forgiveness and remove what doesn't belong, and then be able to stay in that open flow state that Dale was just talking about and he's talked about through most of the show. So thank you for that, Dale. And would you like to make any announcements, upcoming events where people might hear more about you? Or
well, we're just quickly
still planning to come to Oswego?
Yeah, yeah, I'll be there in a few weeks. It's like the 18th, 19th, 20th, 20th, 21st, 22nd, something like that. Yeah, I'll be actually tomorrow. I'm doing a still point breathwork session in Princeton, New Jersey tomorrow. Going trick or treating with my kids tonight, and then first thing in the morning, before the sun comes up, hitting the road. And I'm doing just a single session, which is a 3-hour. Single breathwork session tomorrow in Princeton, New Jersey. That's on my website. And then I'll be at the Center for Spiritual Living in Morristown, New Jersey, outside of Atlantic City, Sunday and Monday. And then I'll be in Tarpon Springs, Florida, the weekend after that. And then I'm in Oswego. And then I've got, Williamsburg, Virginia, Annapolis, Maryland, Haddon Township, New Jersey, Atlanta. Well, Marietta, Georgia, I'll be out in Denver. Well, Black Hawk, Colorado, right around the solstice, winter solstice, at a gathering. So there's a lot coming. Just go on DaleAllenHoffman.com, and it's all listed.
Wonderful. Well, we greatly appreciate, I know I greatly appreciate your being here and being able to listen to you on these Fridays. I just want to say, extend my gratitude for you, to you, for agreeing to do that this year. So come back again and join us on Monday and all week, but especially each Friday for the rest of the year. Dale has agreed to be here and share more of what he's learned and what he is learning. And in the meantime, do what you can to achieve that open state. Recognize anything that in you that's less than love, and use some of the tools available to dismantle it, and help us around the world by having the best year yet of your eternal life. Thank you all. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com.
Continuously, 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 continuously.